paper. Welcome to episode 81 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Nicholas Claddis, an interdisciplinary artist and papermaker who lives and works in Iowa City, Iowa. He is the papermaking specialist at the University of Iowa Center for the Book, where he lectures and manages the Oakdale Paper Research Facility. Claddis is an active researcher and practitioner of traditional and non-traditional papermaking processes. For 6 years, he lived and worked in Echizen, Japan, an area with over 1,500 years of papermaking history, and continues to maintain an active relationship with the papermaking community there. He regularly contributes to the Future of Craft Villages research group at Fukui Prefectural University and serves on the executive committee of Imidate Artfield, a nonprofit arts organization based in Echizen. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Nicholas Claddis, welcome to Paper Talk.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah. I want to tell a little story about how we met. It's a good papermaking story and social media story. So in 2019, the end of 2019, my husband and I were traveling to Japan to meet our son who was studying there. And I wanted to do some papermaking things, and I didn't feel comfortable myself. So I was kind of looking around who was in Japan. And I noticed on Facebook that a member of IATMA was in Echizen, and I knew Echizen was a papermaking village. And so I wrote to her. I thought maybe she was based there, and she, you know, said that I was going to be there in a couple of weeks, and could she, you know, show me around or something. I just was kind of fishing. And she said, no, she was just there for a residency, but that you were there and I should reach out to you. So I did. And you were very welcoming, and you helped Ted and me get there and spent a wonderful day with us at the end of 2019. And I don't think I've traveled much since because of COVID. It's now summer, end of summer, or beginning of fall 2021. So anyways, long little intro, but thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, that was a really fun time when you guys came. And I remember ending that whole thing with sitting in a room filled with paper with a bunch of craftspeople. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And the wonderful Japanese food. Yeah. But let's start with your childhood, where you grew up, any art that you did, and sort of how you wound your way to paper.
Okay. It's pretty fresh in my head right now because I was visiting, I actually visited you on this trip too, but I was visiting my mother in Colorado, who I hadn't seen in a while, and she has saved a lot of childhood artifacts. She's done a really good job of that. And I, there was, I think it was third or fourth grade. There's a folder, in the front of the folder was a note from my teacher. And it said, I'm really charmed by all of the books that Nick makes. This is in elementary school. And then there were the books in this folder, and they are totally absurd. You know, a lot of books about turtles. So I really liked making things and also writing stories. I was always kind of doing that kind of stuff. And we even found this, this is kind of weird. We found this drawing made with Sumi ink that I had done maybe in fourth grade. And it was of a tree, and then pasted on top were these really nice, like, translucent sheets of paper for petals. And then I had tried writing Japanese on it. And this is an elementary school. And I don't remember making this thing at all. And I saw it in my box. And two of the Japanese characters that I had tried to write, they were very bad, are two characters for stand and one for paper, which are both in the name of the workshop that I learned papermaking and etchizen. Oh. And so we were kind of joking that I'm a time traveler.
Yeah.
Because I just don't remember that stuff at all. So looking into that was really interesting. And I don't think I had any other real connection to Japan going forward other than my interest in paper. And and then I went to a visual and performing arts high school, many years later. And
where was this?
That was in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
So my family had moved. I moved there in the middle of my junior year of high school, which, one would think would be a pretty stressful thing. But actually, because I was going to that kind of school, I started to be surrounded by like-minded people. And it felt like a very kind of organic transition for me. So that was sort of a happy story in the end. But really enjoyed that time, and that kind of got me into painting and printmaking and all these things, which I would go on to do in university.
Okay. Yeah. What's the name of that school?
Klassen School of Advanced Studies in Oklahoma City. Yeah.
Okay. And so that was just sort of fortuitous. Your family moved for other reasons. Because where I live, people move here for their children to ski. So the whole family sacrifices for their child to do their dream. But that was just a happy accident.
Accident. Yeah. I was so nervous too.
I bet.
Move it at that time. I was really happy that it worked out. I had really generous, caring teachers, and there were just cool people in the school who wanted to talk about art and literature and all the things that I kind of, could nerd out on at that time.
Right.
Wow.
And then where did you end up going to college?
I went to Trinity University it's a small liberal arts school in San Antonio, Texas. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I told you, but I applied to go there. I got in, but I didn't end up going there. So I grew up in Bryan College Station. My dad was a professor at A&M. And then I applied there and Southwestern in Georgetown, Texas.
Yeah.
And then the University of the South, where I ended up going in Tennessee.
Yeah, that's great. That was also the whole Trinity University thing was also a happy accident in a weird way, because the year after I arrived there, they finished construction on this brand new art building that was just equipped with, brand new molds and decals and vats and a nice drainage system and all this gear that, I had not seen before and that I was educated in. And that was all pretty fortuitous.
And so why did you choose Trinity?
A lot of it was kind of moving around, to different schools, looking at different schools and enjoying the kind of tight-knit community that was there. But in all honesty, a lot of it was just because they gave, good scholarship.
Yeah, right.
And,
right.
Financial aid and things like that. So you went
there to study art, but you had no idea that papermaking was going to be something there.
No idea.
Wow.
Yeah. No idea.
Okay,
yeah.
So... how did that evolve?
I was taking a printmaking class. And up to that point, I had been kind of a undisciplined artist, I would say. I was just into experimenting, collaging, and throwing paint and shapes on canvases. And I was doing some pretty weird stuff. And but I met a teacher, John Lee, at Trinity University, and he was teaching a printmaking class, and his first year was also my first year. So he was new. And we got along, quickly and well. And the kind of standout thing I remember from his class is that he emphasized tool making in a printmaking class. And I think it took us kind of a while to make our first print. And for me, I loved that. I just loved all the intricacies of making tools, you know, knowing material more and what materials will work to make tools and to like do things with.
Like what kind of tools were you making?
We made a etching needle. We always made like bamboo handles. We made pens. John taught us how to make pens, like ink pens. We made a bone folder. And I remember going over to John's house. I think it was that first year of college. I remember going to his house and he just had this bag of bones. And we just like, sanded them down and polished them. And then we did some wood bending with some bamboo to make the handle. And that was really, really great. Later on, I think it was that first semester, we also made baden, you know, it's the kind of round disc that's used to push for Japanese woodblock prints, which is one of John's specialties. And he's since gotten really deep into the whole baden making thing, and they're just beautiful. And he had a really good understanding of kind of the inner workings of that tool. And you know, some of those are what, like $3,000 for this like really simple but well-made object. And so that all that interest in tool making naturally took me into like, well, how do I make the substrate, you know, that I'm putting my prints on? Like, how do I go as deep, you know, to make the actual thing these are being put on? And so then I started making paper, and both types of paper, honestly, pretty soon after, like, you know, I think a lot of people do the European and then the Japanese. I kind of was doing both concurrently, trying them out.
And these were classes that were offered? Or
they were actually within printmaking class. So within the printmaking, and this is something that just kept going through my career. Like even in grad school, I was a printmaking graduate. I did printmaking MFA program, but we had a paper studio. And I think in grad school, I made maybe one or two prints, like traditional prints. I was mostly making paper and paper sculpture and things like that. But in undergrad, I was still kind of making the prints, but also just thinking about the most kind of traditional way of making paper and how to make it as well as I could, you know, in that studio. And it was just great because we had all these new facilities. And John was very supportive, and John had actually done his certificate. He had studied printmaking at the University of Iowa and had done his certificate at the Center for the Book. And so he had a pretty deep understanding of paper making and was making his own paper for some of his own projects as well.
Right. And this is the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa, where you are now. We'll get to that. But I think it's interesting how you're saying, I think you were in printmaking probably because there were no, the papermaking wasn't official place to be, right? There are very few schools still where that can be. And when John went to Iowa, he got a certificate. Mm-hmm. I think now there are degrees, but is that true per se?
Yeah, that's a great, I think it's, yeah, there's, I can, there are only a handful of schools that have just like a devoted papermaking class. At Trinity didn't have that, but we were able to have enough freedom within the printmaking discipline to do those things.
Right. And John is still at Trinity and papermaking is still part of their program, right?
Yeah. I mean, I just talked to John a couple of days ago, actually, over the phone, and he's still, you know, because of the pandemic, they had to kind of put a pause on paper. Papermaking is a really tough one to do for distance learning, you know? But so he's been doing some other programs, but I think they're headed back to normal, and, or if not totally back to normal. So hopefully we get other interested, people interested in papermaking, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me a little about, you said you were doing sculpture. So how did you get into sculpture, and did you have any training, or were you just kind of making sculptural prints? And I don't know.
Yeah, I have no I would say I have little to no formal training in sculpture, in the sense that like I've never taken a sculpture class, but I've taken, you know, I took all the 3D design and all that mm-hmm. stuff. But mm-hmm. but I think what happened to me with printmaking, and you know, this is sort of, I think that the repetition of printmaking is a beautiful aspect of it, and also the kind of mathematics required, the precision required to make a good print is mm-hmm. is also can be a really beautiful thing. But I think there was a point where I started to really thrive on playing in the studio, and by playing I mean just kind of like putting two things together and creating with materials I've made and things that I have, and having a bit of fun with it, that I felt printmaking wasn't really affording me in, mm-hmm. in the ways at that time, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know there are like so many ways to make a print, that there are a lot of kind of more freeing ways, but flat work was just not appealing to me anymore in that context. And I like to call kind of the stuff I started making in grad school, I like to call it 2.5D uh-huh. in the sense that it's like, it's 2D, it has 2D elements, it has 3D elements, it kind of uses a wall and doesn't use a wall. And it's, you know, and it kind of, it's very attached to the book arts, I think. And mm-hmm. and it's around that time, like late university, and then during grad school, when I became really cognizant of that term book arts, you know. And I think that term, in terms of my practice, just gives me a lot more freedom to work within various disciplines, and not just kind of what I considered a little bit too traditional or limiting when making 3D work with
right printing. Okay, and where did you go to grad school, and sort of what was your thesis work there?
Well, I went to University of Dallas. It's a really small program at the Braniff Graduate School. We have a little art village there, and there's a papermaking studio attached to the printmaking studio. And I loved it. I had really great teachers there. It's very separated by discipline, but students are encouraged to cross those boundaries. Mm-hmm. And on one's committee to pass your oral exams and all that, all discipline heads are there. So you kind of need to get advice from a lot of different people as you're doing your master's work. And to me, and that was great because I could get tips from the ceramics professor, from the sculpture, from painting, from art history, and all these perspectives on the work. And yeah. That was really nice. So my thesis, my exhibition was at the Irving Arts Center. It was called Farthest Home. And I did this big cast a laminate cast of paper, a person mm-hmm. lying in a bed, almost like they were sleeping or in some deep slumber, like the silhouette of a person. And then surrounded by it was this kind of dreamlike imagery in one room. And then in the adjacent room, there was a reading room where people could actually touch and handle three different book objects. So again, like really, there was this very 3D sculptural practice, and then like a more traditional, you know, trying to use appropriate technique and playing with that technique to meld different things together with handmade books. Yeah.
Right. And did you focus on Eastern or Western papermaking then, or both, or?
The work sort of defied regionalization mm-hmm. in a weird way. Like it was, I had a ton of Kozo stuff in there mm-hmm. that I had made, like I beat, cooked and beat and made thinner sheets and some thicker Kozo sheets too. And then there were a lot of cotton, bamboo, abaca, so it was sort of a mix of a lot of different things in all of those projects. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then, so what did you do after college?
Well, what I was just describing was grad school.
That's what I meant. Grad school.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. So after grad school, well, that's kind of connects to the work I was making when I was using these Kozo fibers, I was doing so to make objects that are light, but still sculptural.
Mm-hmm.
So Kozo is very long fiber and, it's strong, translucent, but lightweight. And so for making these sculptural objects that I was hanging or putting into space in different ways, it was really a perfect fiber. And I started getting into kind of reading more about Japanese papermaking and in my last year of grad school. And I was in Texas still for another year after that, just working and saving money. And then I got kind of a little bit tired. I don't know how to say, like tired, like sort of tired of not knowing deeply about this practice that I had been doing mm-hmm. at work. And then I was also kind of wanting to see how people do this practically. Mm-hmm. How they live within it, within papermaking. I couldn't get that where I was, you know, I just couldn't get that in Dallas or in Texas, you know, or in the US. So, I got a scholarship and then to go to Japan to, study papermaking, but I had to find a sponsor, and to find a sponsor, I had to find it had to be an institution of higher ed that had a dedicated faculty member who could supervise me in papermaking. I sent email after email. I had a few leads, and then they led to nowhere. And it just didn't work out. So, and I was also, you know, I didn't speak Japanese and I was trying to formulate emails and I was getting some help, you know, from friends, cause I had studied abroad in Japan, when I was in college actually. So I was trying my best, but, it didn't work out. And then also another thing was the time limitation. I think that this scholarship was for 9 months or something. And I was already thinking at that time, I was like, that's not going to be, I really want to just be immersed in a place. And I want to be learning from people who do this, you know, for their livelihood, you know? So I applied for this English teaching program. It's called the JET program. And I got that job, and I put down for they give you 3 placement choices. And I think most people are putting like Tokyo or Kyoto or something. And I just put all papermaking villages.
Oh.
and the first one I put, you know, was Echizen.
Okay.
I've been doing some research and found that, that really appealed to me. So I got that job. I went there. I had taught English before overseas, actually, between university and graduate school. So the program put me in this really kind of nice high level high school mm-hmm. in Fukui Prefecture, where I could teach writing to students. Like mm-hmm. I was like the primary teacher. I was mm-hmm. not an assistant teacher, and I could teach writing in these circumstances to international economics students in high school, and they were great students. And then later on down the road, when I was like immersed in papermaking, they would actually come out to the studio and make paper or volunteer for events and stuff. So that was really, really cool too.
So how long was the JET program?
So I was there, I was working in some capacity with the JET program for 6 years the whole time I was in Japan.
Okay. Okay. So yeah. It just continued.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about that. Yeah. And then how did you get connected to the papermakers in Echizen?
So my first year I went to the paper village and I went to the museum, Udatsu Paper and Crafts Museum. And they had me do this workshop. I think it was like $50 and you make 2 sheets. You know, I think I was able, I didn't speak any Japanese. I was gesturing and I spoke like, you know, Japanese papermaking words. So I knew Sugeta or Nagashizuki or things like that. And they were really happy with the paper I made. And so I was like,
so you took the workshop?
I did. Yeah. Okay. I took that workshop and they were pleased by the paper. And I went through it pretty fast. And I remember thinking at the time, man, this is really expensive for and then, so I asked them, I was like, is there a place, you know, with whatever Japanese I had at the time, I was like, is there a place I can do this regularly? And they gave me a key to the access to the community studio, which was just, you know, 3-minute walk down the road. And that's for years where I made paper in the evenings, in the weekends. And I was still teaching at this high school. The high school work, you know, it was a great way to pay the bills and also have these long holidays where I could really, you know, just isolate myself in the studio and get a lot of work done. But I did end up also working for Fukui Prefectural University as a lecturer. That's kind of a local university in Fukui Prefecture. They brought me on as an arts instructor and as a researcher in a small fellowship that they had made. And that was great. So I had kind of a lot of jobs going at once. It was pretty stressful at times. Like I feel like I had the craftsperson job, the high school job, the university job. And then I also had to, you know, make art. So it was like trying to balance all these things, you know, was both exciting and stressful.
Yeah. And how were you learning Japanese?
I learned it just by being there.
Forced to, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, very few individuals in the papermaking village speak Japanese. But I also speak English. Yeah. I also took a class. It was twice weekly with this woman, Sato-san, who was kind of like, I don't know, she was like a Japanese mother to me. She would kind of bring food, like dinners to me and like already packed and like, go home and eat, which is great. Cause I was kind of finishing my job, going to the convenience store. And, but for those of you who don't know, like the convenience store in Japan is they're pretty nice, but still it's not the ideal situation. Going to a convenience store, getting like a rice ball and onigiri, eating that in my car and then making paper until like 9 PM, my day. And so like when I on these I think it was Monday and Wednesday or something like that, and it wasn't twice every week but most weeks, she would kind of bring meals, and for an hour we would go over more complicated grammar and things like that, and that was really helpful too for me.
Yeah, that's wow. So yeah, you were taken care of nicely. And I'm curious about what you think, why the why you were given the key to the community center, like so quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, and just talk about that a little bit. Were there other people working there or was it maybe because they wanted it used? I don't, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think my story kind of glosses over the amount of time that, like, I was going to the Sudatsu Paper and Craft Museum. Like it wasn't just the first time. And, it was just the time that I devoted myself to doing this workshop that, you know, and then kind of going back and then asking, right, hey, how can I just keep doing this? And I do think that like showing up with a cursory knowledge of the subject and of like what it requires them knowing that I had done this before, I'd been making this paper, you know, not well necessarily, but like I'd been making objects with this paper, and that I had that devotion in me to just continue this. I think that was important. Definitely having someone in the studio was good for them too, because I would you know kind of clean up the studio, and it became really just a part of me, like going there. And and I remember them, you know, putting a key, hiding place for the key, and then I remember sometimes putting the key through the museum doors when after closing hours, if someone needed it the next day, and you know, it's like all this kind of funny, you know, ritual stuff, right. I was doing that, you know, just for people to practically get into the studio. no one else was really using it except, let's see, one time early in the early years, I saw a woman there who would become a really great teacher of mine, Kato Shizuko. And she's really involved in this project to grow Kozo in the Ikeda Valley of Echizen. And that woman has taught me everything I know about cultivating Kozo. And then she's had a long string of teachers, you know, before when she was young too. And when I went there to this community workshop, I think the first or second time, she was pulling off, peeling off these really large sheets of paper and then doing kind of a momigami thing, like kneading the paper almost like it was dough, you know, and crinkling it. And then she makes these kind of organic sculptures that reach, they're very long. So she connects these paper, but this, you can't see the seams. Mm-hmm. It's all crumpled and they kind of stretch around surfaces and in galleries and things like that. Yeah, and we got along really well. And then she just really devoted her time to this Kozo project. And so I would go out and volunteer for that. So she was one person who was using this workshop. And then the other person is another, like probably one of my greatest friends in Japan, Masuda Yoriyasu, who is now the director of Imarate Art Field. Which is like a contemporary paper arts organization in Fukui, which I got in Echizen, which I became part of and became, I joined the committee and did a lot of work for after that. But when I met him, he was doing a lot of workshops there with students, like university students. And I went to his exhibition, that was like an instant, we really saw eye to eye on like how we think about paper and contemporary art. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was great.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Advisor, a place where you can discover my most popular papermaking and papercraft resources, including information about tools and supplies, how-to videos, and paper tips, all in one place. You can ask the Paper Advisor your paper questions there too. And best of all, it's free. Find the Paper Advisor by going to HelenHebertStudio.com and looking for the free Paper Advisor link in the upper right-hand corner. Now back to the episode.
I'd love for you to give an overview of Echizen, sort of historically, and then what's happening there today. It's such a, I don't know how you can do that in a nutshell, but yeah. I'm sure you can.
No, yeah, I can try to condense it. It's a paper, now it's a fully functioning papermaking community today. I'll start with today because that's kind of easier to talk about. Whereas like a lot of other papermaking villages in Japan, maybe 200 years ago, they had 500 people making paper, but now they have two. Mm-hmm. Right now, to this day, though the number is decreasing, there are still a lot of people, practicing craftspeople in Echizen. And it's in this area called Imadate. Actually, the traditional word would be Goka, which means five villages, because technically there are five villages all connected. But they're seamless from our perspective. It's just like you walk through those streets and you'll hear people making paper and you'll smell the tororo aoi, the stuff used for neri to formation aid to increase the distribution, enhance the distribution of the fibers and slow drainage of water. And that's today. I'm describing, you know, the contemporary Echizen. But the history of this village in papermaking goes back 1500 years. And it's said that a goddess appeared up the river and she taught villagers how to make paper. And I think out of context, that seems really, you know, fantastical, but there are a lot of theories that this is likely a Korean or Chinese immigrant who is teaching you know, these villagers how to do something to make a living off season. Mm-hmm. Also, the water was very pure, great, and it still is really great quality, cold, you know, snow melt from the mountains. And at that time, the Nanetsu Basin, which is where this is, was a weaving community. There were a lot of weavers there. So it had a it already had this textile foundation going on. And mm-hmm. So for people to comprehend this papermaking knowledge, it seemed pretty organic from what I've read and researched. Yeah, from then on, there was a shrine to a god and goddess of water, and that gradually morphed. Like, the religious history of Japan is very complicated, but it gradually Sure. morphed into the shrine for the papermaking goddess, which still exists today. And that means that papermaking is embedded in a lot of these people's spiritual life, practical life, right, livelihood, earning a living, and also simultaneously connected to like how they relate to the world in any kind of deeper way. And that definitely shows. And I think, yeah, that's a pretty good, so it's a long history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of different things.
And so, yeah, how many artisans are there about making paper today? And like, where are they? Most of them are making sheets to sell, I presume.
Like, yeah, where are they? I definitely welcome fact checking on this, but I think the last number I heard was maybe 350 total people just working in the industry, mm-hmm. Which is a lot, but that doesn't include distribution and things like that. So I think it's 350 right. people who are actually in the wet room making mm-hmm. the sheet. Mm-hmm. Now this includes machine made. This includes a lot of paper. There are so many types right. of paper. Right. There's the, you know, quote unquote traditional Nagashizuki. There's the paper using gampi called torinoko. There's more decorative sheets, suminagashi, paper made for use in suminagashi. Large scale Japanese painting papers being made. You know, it's there's such a range of things there. And yes, all the mills are selling their paper to clients. You know, the really famous one that maybe a lot of your listeners know is Iwano Ichibei, who's ninth generation, and he's selling a lot of paper that's used for conservation in the Louvre, you know, today, and he has been doing that. And so, yeah, these people, a lot of times it's almost like they have more demand than they have people to make the paper, mm-hmm. you know, which is a good thing. But then also, trends are changing, and interior design in Japan has shifted. A lot of the ways these papers were used has kind of fallen off or are being changed into other things. And that, on that note too, I found that a lot of these craftspeople to be very flexible with, like, you know, and innovative. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. there's Igarashi Masami, who's making this stuff called food paper, which she and her son go to, I think, schools and hospitals, and they get all this food waste, like cabbage, things that have just been thrown out, and they process it into paper, into washi, and that's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. We met her. She wasn't doing that, I think.
We
right?
did meet her.
She was making big sheets with two other women. But I saw a blog post or something about her afterwards, the story with her and her son. And listeners, by the way, I did a detailed, I think it's three blog posts that I'll put in the show notes when I was about my trip to Japan, and particularly the visit to Echizen. We visited her. We saw lace paper being made and walked through the village. It's small. These five towns you're talking about, I don't think we went to all of them. We did drive a couple of times that day. But yeah, you can read about my journey in those blog posts. Cool. So tell me a little bit about Imidate Art Field and your involvement.
So it's a nonprofit arts organization. And the first kind of form it took, was an exhibition of experimental paper art. And this was in 1979. This is all really fresh too, because I'm writing about this. I'm writing an article about this whole history. But just for context, North American Hand Paper Makers, I think was founded in 1981. And IAPMA, the International Association of Papermaking Artists, was formed in 1986. So in 1979, you have this kind of ragtag group of artists coming together in Echizen using paper, handmade paper, to make really wild sculptural, I mean, installations, like just bizarre. Some of it's just so, I was recently sent all of the catalogs going back to 1979, and it's just a treasure trove of material to look through. And this was the group of people doing this. One prominent guy was this guy, Kawai Isamu, who was a really great artist, who had traveled around the world. He lived in New York for a while, but he's from Fukui Prefecture. He came back, and they had been having a committee to form this paper exhibition, but he was not a paper maker, and he, you know, hadn't really used handmade paper in his work that much. And I think that goes for a lot of these founding artists. They weren't craftspeople, but they were all from that area. So they had just as much of kind of like a whatever claim to the, you know, doing this in this spot.
Yeah.
He unfortunately was hospitalized during planning with cancer. And to cheer him up, I heard, and I've seen pictures of this, Masuda Yoriyasu, the man I was talking about before, he told me they wrapped his little truck that he drove around in like a rope made from washi, and they suspended it in the gallery. So this truck is like to show the strength of Japanese paper, you know, they're lifting a whole truck with it. And they did this, as Matsuda-san says, to cheer him up while he was in the hospital. really sweet. And the exhibition went off. It was in November 1979. And then I think it was January of the next year, just a couple months later, he passed away. Kawai-san passed away. And I've been kind of digging into his life a lot and looking at his work and how admired he was by people. And he just seemed like a really optimistic person. And that's kind of how that started. And so after that, they would gather artists together in the village. They did some satellite exhibitions in other places, but it was always about bringing art to the village, keeping it in the village. And that, I think, is a really, you know, great mission. It wasn't about impressing critics or, you know, doing any of that. It was all just about, let's form the dialogue between artists and craftspeople, and also just townspeople, you know. So it was like they wanted to show paper art to the people they would see in their daily lives, and it took a lot of different forms since 1979. An art camp developed in the 90s where it was like a residency. So now they were bringing artists into the village where they could live for a couple weeks and make the work. But what was so great, I think, about this is that everyone had a face. Like the artist has a face, and then a stone's throw from where they're making the work is the craftsperson who made the paper they're using, you know? So everything just has this intimacy, and no one is faceless in that transaction, that relationship. And I think that's just a really beautiful model.
And the fact that, it's for the village, it's produced there. I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
And not to speed you up too much, but Yeah. What's happening with that today? Cause we have a lot of other things I want to touch on.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. I can talk a long time.
That's
about
okay.
This stuff. And it's so fresh. But yeah. Right now, so it's continuing, Murata Airfield. And when I was working there, we kind of did open up to international participants, as long as their work kind of has a relationship to, you know, paper in some way. And that includes residency. So we had, you know, like ID, did this residency. I've done the residency, and a few artists from France, the Netherlands, kind of all over have done this residency. Mm-hmm. Now, because of the pandemic, I think they're limiting, international involvement, you know, for understandable reasons, but they are as active as always planning. They meet in as a committee, which you met a lot of them at that house when you were partying. And they've been, even with the pandemic, kind of thinking about workshops and things that they can do, or online stuff. When I first started working at the Center for the Book, we had some students make films of their paper objects and books, these really nice films, filming helped by this guy, Barry Phipps, a really great artist. And we sent that data to them, and they projected them on this big sheet of washi in this old storehouse. So we're still trying to keep the conversation moving and keeping the relationship up.
Right. So when I was in Etch-A-Zen at the end of 2019, the call was out for a position at the University of Iowa because Tim Barrett was leaving. You can describe that better than I'm not really sure of the relationship between his position and this new one, but, and I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, you would be perfect for that job. And so so I mentioned that, and you said, oh yeah, I'm applying, and here you are, you're there now. So tell us, about that transition and what you're doing in Iowa.
I don't think anything else would have taken me out of Japan other than like a really dire family emergency or this position. I mean, just the idea of being able to be around like-minded people, and to teach others what I've learned, was too appealing. And so it was kind of a no-brainer for me. And I immediately applied, and, the transition, you know, was tough with the COVID stuff going on, but it was also, I also received a lot of support from colleagues and the student body is just, you know, filled with independent, and talented people. So it really, honestly, I felt it would be harder to transition here, but it was, Iowa City itself is kind of an easy place to live. There were definitely challenges though. Like I had reverse culture shock for a long time, and still sometimes that comes up, but it was just being able to teach all of these things that I devoted my life to up till that point was a really meaningful thing for me.
So describe your position and what you're doing there.
So I teach papermaking, and it comes in a lot of forms. So I teach regional papermaking styles. So right now I'm teaching an Asian and Islamic papermaking class. And so, you know, we just did Nepalese style papermaking, and then we'll do Islamic, Indo-Islamic style papermaking, and then we'll do a Japanese papermaking. And I kind of like teaching this way, and then deconstructing the borders, you know. So I like teaching the regional styles and then also saying, you know, but these overlap in a lot of ways. And none of these things happen in a vacuum. And I think that's really important too. And then I teach a European papermaking class, which would be more like your kind of traditional mold and decal. But then I in my own curriculum in these classes, I've brought in a lot of sculptural practice, pulp painting, sound and performance and installation and all of this stuff. So we also have an advanced topics in papermaking course where students who have already taken one papermaking course can come and do these, we have like almost like a think tank of papermakers, and we're all kind of brainstorming our projects and that's a really fun one. And then we have a paperworks course too, which is for people to just devote themselves to more alternative styles, like doing casts and making installations and things like that. So I've kind of brought my Imadate art field, you know, my site specificity, my love of this kind of like community art practice and alternative styles to the UICB as well, and not just a traditional focus.
Right. And I know I've been to the UICB, so I know there is a papermaking classroom where I think these courses are happening, but there's also the Oakdale facility. What's happening there?
Yeah, Oakdale. I'm here now, actually. This is where I'm in from. And this is a paper research facility that we do a lot of paper production. So if an artist requires a specific type of paper, we will produce it for a fee. And I'll also do research here. So research into papermaking techniques or materials. And then what I've done is transition the space to a gallery / educational space. So during the pandemic, we had a cap on the number of people we could have in our other classroom, but this space is bigger. So I was able to bring students in here, and now I'm just going to continue doing that, like bring students in every now and then, because it's just a great way to show them what an operating mill looks like. And then I there was this lab space that I cleared out and renovated, turned into a gallery. So now we have a little gallery here as well, where we can show paper objects and sculptures and things like that. And so, yeah, it's the purpose of this space is, I think, evolving and changing. But it is such a gem to have it for students and for me too.
Right. And I just lost my train of thought. It was going somewhere. Your own work. So do you have a studio space, or do you just use this facilities and you continue to make your own work, I presume?
Yeah. Well, it gets a little tough. The balance issue hasn't changed, right? Like finding space for that. I think that that's just an age old problem and it never goes away. And I think we just find better strategies, but I make work here at the Oakdale facility. And then I have a dry room at my home that I make, I can assemble things in. So I'm still making work. It's just a slower process. And I'm also doing a lot of research and writing right now about the discipline of papermaking. So I'm keeping it going. We have a dry room here and a wet room, and I can kind of stretch out because the wet room is very, I think you've been here before, right?
Yeah.
The wet room's pretty spacious and has nice light. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And you had a couple of recommendations. Let's get to those. So tell me about the book Science Fiction.
Okay. Whitechapel Gallery in London, they released these books of collected kind of, it's a hodgepodge of like articles, short stories, reviews of exhibitions about certain subjects. And a lot of them are amazing and interesting, but science fiction in particular is kind of a funny one, because when I read that book and see a lot of the things artists are doing or have done within the realm of science fiction, it just feels so far removed from hand papermaking that it's interesting to me. And it's just so different. And I try to think to myself, how does hand papermaking fit into artistic practice in the future, like looking forward? And it kind of like it makes me question a lot of things, and I appreciate that about it. My grandpa was an astrophysicist, and that was like, he always kind of wanted us to go into science or math. And I just feel like that there's a lot of interesting exploration there, looking at contrasts between what those artists are thinking about and then what we artists who are thinking about more handmade analog practice are thinking about. And I like,
yeah, I forgot about that. And your grandpa was in Los Alamos, and my father was a nuclear physicist who also did work in Los Alamos. And my father's gone, but I think more and more now about how, the brain works with science and art in a similar way, and how I really feel like my father and I were similar in more ways than we realized when we were together.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. And then you have a soba noodle recipe from Echizen, and you said you were going to share it. Maybe you can literally, we can put it in the show notes.
Yeah,
tell me about it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Let's put it in the show notes, because it's pretty complicated. Well, it's the ingredients are simple, but it's complicated. But what I will say is that Echizen is well known for its soba, and in the papermaking village is my favorite soba shop.
And these are buckwheat noodles.
Buckwheat noodles. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're chewy, and they're served cold. Well, there are hot and cold versions, but the one I like is served cold with grated radish on top. And it's a great refreshing meal to have after making a lot of paper. So I can give you that recipe. And then good luck to whoever wants to try it. It's a lot like paper make. It's just challenging. Yeah. And I fail all the time, by the way. So like, I've tried to like get the ratio of different flours right, because buckwheat flour in the US is always a little too coarse, and it's similar to paper in that you kind of make a pulp at the beginning and then you roll it out flat, and it's almost like a sheet of paper.
So you're making the noodles yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, cool. Okay. And then you had a music recommendation.
Yeah.
You pronounce the name.
I think it's Zaloris, and that Zaloris White. And I that's part of like why I like and recommend this is I've been trying to explore, for lack of a better word, my Greek roots and think about what the Greek community was in the early and mid 20th century. And Zaloris, he plays the lauto, which is a kind of like a lute from Crete. And he sings, but then you have this, Jim White, I think is his name. He plays the drums for rock bands. And then they do this collaboration called Zaloris White. And I feel like it reflects a lot of my kind of search for what that culture is. And then, mixed with a more alternative presence. I think it's just great music, to listen to while you're in the studio or doing, more kind of like busy work. Yeah.
Cool. All right. And let's, tell me where we can find you online first. NicholasCladis.com. And we'll put these links in the show notes. Is there a University of Iowa, any website that's of interest to readers? The Center for the Book or...
Yeah, check out the Center for the Book website, definitely.
Okay.
And that'll be you can put that in there too. If anyone here is interested in pursuing a MFA or a certificate in the book arts, it's a great program.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And then I know you're trying to keep connections. You already mentioned one with Echizen and Japan. So tell me kind of what's on the docks. I know COVID is still prohibiting travel to Japan, but.
There's a Japan Foundation grant that I received, and that includes travel to Echizen to do a more comprehensive publication about Imadate art field and the history of it. We received the, here at the Center for the Book, we received an arts and humanities grant for myself and five of our grad students to go to Echizen for a couple weeks. That obviously has been delayed. But we're still planning for it. And then we also received an international programs grant to bring two of the Etchi Zen craftspeople to Japan, or sorry, to Iowa. Yeah. And so there's a lot of kind of back and forth exchange work being done. And I'm really, it's pretty sad that I haven't been able to get back in a year because of the restrictions, but I have a piece right now showing in the Yatma show that's in Aichi prefecture in Japan, and Masada Yoriyasu, he actually I had given him that piece before I left, and he took it down and installed it for me, and he also has his own piece in that show too. So
oh cool. And IAPMA is the International Association of Papermakers and Paper Artists. And this episode is going to publish a little bit. Well, I don't know. I think it'll be after. There's an online conference happening September and October. I know you're presenting one of the dates. Which date are you presenting?
I think it's October 2nd.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think that will have passed, but maybe it'll be available online afterwards. Yeah. Anything else exciting coming up?
anything exciting coming up? A lot of things in the works.
Yeah. Good.
But yeah, nothing. I think that's all of it. That's
yeah.
A lot.
Oh, well, I forgot. I did want to mention that you and I are planning to take a group to Japan. Yeah. Hopefully in May or June of 2023. And, I'm looking forward to that. I think it will be really fun. We'll concentrate on Etchi Zen and probably spend some time in Kyoto as well.
Yeah.
And I'll put those links to the blog posts, and within there, read listeners, you can find out how to fill out a form if you're interested. I have a little list going, or you send me an email. I can't even remember now because it's been kind of waylaid by COVID, but I'm collecting names, and I know it's going to be a great trip when we get to do it.
Yeah.
So, for sure. All right, Nick. Well, thanks for coming on the show. It's been great hearing your story.
Thanks for having me, Helen. Take care.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.